This is Jake DeShazer. He was born in 1912 near Salem, Oregon. He joined the Army in 1940 and became Staff Sergeant in 1941. Upon hearing the radio about Pearl Harbor when he was on a military base, he said, "They are going to have to pay for this." He volunteered for a special unit formed to attack Japan. There were 24 crews that were selected from the 17th Bomber Wing, and they received intensive training at Eglin Field, Florida, for 3 weeks beginning 1 March 1942. The crews undertook practice carrier deck takeoffs along with extensive flying exercises involving low-level and night flying, low-altitude bombing, and overwater navigation. The mission would be to fly modified B-25 Mitchell bombers launched from an aircraft carrier to attack Japan. First time ever thought about taking off from a carrier deck with heavy bombers. Notice the bomber at the very back. That's the 16th one to take off, and that's the one that Jake was the bombardier in. They went over Nagoya, Japan, and bombed it. Here they are with number 16 taking off. The name of the plane was the Bat Out of Hell. Because the Japanese had possible intelligence that the Hornet, the aircraft carrier, was approaching Japan, they took off earlier than they had planned to take off, and as a result, every one of the planes crashed. None of them had enough fuel to be able to land at their intended landing sites. So they ran out of fuel over Ningpo, China, and he was injured in his fall into a cemetery, and along with the rest of the crew, he was captured the very next day by the Japanese. During his captivity, DeShazer was sent to Tokyo with the survivors of another Doolittle crew and was held in a series of POW camps both in Japan and China for 40 months, 34 of them in solitary confinement. He was severely beaten and malnourished while three of the crew were executed by a firing squad and another died of slow starvation. DeShazer's sentence was commuted to life imprisonment by Emperor Hirohito. But on August the 20th, 1945, he and the others in the camp at Beijing, China, were freed by American paratroopers who landed in the camp. Staff Sergeant DeShazer was awarded both the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Purple Heart for his part in the Doolittle Raid. By the way, there he is hiding on the right-hand side. While he was in prison, he persuaded one of the Japanese guards to loan him his Bible. He was an unbeliever at that point. He only had possession of the Bible for 3 weeks, but he searched it diligently, and I don't know what content it was that he believed, but it did focus upon Jesus Christ and focused upon the truth of what Jesus Christ has done. I certainly would like to think that he came to understand that Jesus Christ guarantees everlasting life to believers. He ended up changing his whole approach as a result of the time that he had in studying his Bible. He started learning a few words of Japanese and started treating his captors with respect, which the guards reciprocated. After his release, DeShazer studied to be a missionary and eventually, in 1959, returned to Japan with his wife, Florence, Actually, they returned in 1948. In 1959, he moved to Nagoya to establish a church in the city that he had bombed. He retired after 30 years of missionary service in Japan and returned to Salem, Oregon, where he spent the last years of his life. He received the Presidential Medal of Honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal, and is in the running for the Congressional Medal of Honor. We'll tell you something, an interesting story that happened as a result of one of the books that was written about him. But that will be later. Here he is with medals that he had won. Why is it that I have chosen Jake DeShazer? He had every reason. He had every reason to thoroughly hate the Japanese people because of what had happened to him after he had crashed in China. But after he discovered what God had to say in the Bible, he realized that he was in a little different situation. He was no longer able to fight in the military that had sent him over for a very important mission. Now his mission was to seek to have an impact upon those who had meant to do him wrong. Joseph, in the passage that we are going to consider, in Genesis 44 and 45, had every reason from a human standpoint to bear his physical brothers ill for all that they had done to him. After all, when he went out as sent by his father to check up on them and see how the brothers were doing, they saw him coming and they said, "Here comes that dreamer. Let's see what happens to his dreams." They threw him into a pit. They were thinking about killing him. They ended up selling him to slave traders, and he went down to Egypt as a result, and they slew a couple of kid goats and poured the blood over his outfit, and as a result they told the father that he had been killed by some wild beast. As Joseph was in Egypt, he showed himself to be very faithful in Potiphar's household, and as a result of that he became the steward in charge of the whole household. But then under trumped up charges, he was thrown into prison, accused of trying to attack Potiphar's wife. While he was in prison, there were two, he gradually again, because of his faithfulness, rose to a position of importance. And so he was looking over all the prisoners. And there were two prisoners. One was a butler and one was the wine taster for the Pharaoh, and lo and behold, they were both very sad. And he asked them why they were so sad, and they both had a dream. And no one was able to interpret the dream. Joseph said, "Well, I can interpret dreams." And he proceeded to tell the one that he would be lifted up in 3 days, restored to his position. But the other one would be executed. And he said, "Remember me when you are freed." But he was not remembered. And he stayed in prison another couple of years. And then Pharaoh had a couple of wild dreams. And he couldn't find anyone to interpret the dreams. So the one who had been restored to his position said, "You know, I know someone, a Hebrew who's in prison, who who is able to interpret dreams. And he interpreted these two dreams, and they came out exactly as he said that they would. So Pharaoh called for Joseph. And Joseph interpreted the two dreams. He said that there would be 7 years of great plenty, followed by 7 years of famine that would be worse than Egypt had ever seen. Egypt was not used to famines. They have the longest river in the whole world, 4,000 miles long, that flows down through Egypt. You can have a drought in one area, and another area gets plenty of rainfall. So the Nile River always provided them with sustenance. They had never planned for anything. They never had a rainy day fund. But Joseph said that they needed to mend their ways, because after the 7 years of plenty, there wasn't going to be any food around. So he advised Pharaoh to pick someone, a wise man, to put in charge of the program. And lo and behold, Pharaoh did not do what would be politically correct. He didn't go looking around for an Egyptian. He concluded that this man that God had given this wisdom to would be the best one to administer the program. Well, lo and behold, what happened? They store up all of the food during the 7 years. And then in the first year of famine, Jacob looks at his boys and he says, "What are you looking at each other for? Go down to Egypt, get some food for us." So they went down, and guess what? There you have the brothers meeting up with Joseph. And Joseph knew them, but they had no inkling that their brother was the one that they were dealing with. Is this going to be the time for Joseph to take revenge? It certainly has that appearance at points as Joseph is seeking to find out what his brothers are actually thinking. I need to pull something together that we haven't yet really made a big point of here in Genesis. Throughout this book, the lineage that God has been setting aside has been focused upon one person. Only one. One at a time. So for example, how many sons did Abraham have? Two. Ishmael and Isaac. But God selected one of them to receive the blessing, through whom the lineage would proceed, and through whom the blessing, the Abrahamic covenant, would proceed. Isaac had two sons. And what happened there? God selected Jacob. Esau received a blessing, but it was a much smaller blessing than the blessing that Jacob received. And the focus was always on one son. But there's something major that happened with Jacob. There are 12 sons that receive recognition, and each one of them is the head of a tribe. The nation was to be built out of those 12 sons, out of those 12 brothers, those 12 tribes. And although there would be a special blessing upon Jacob, son Joseph, and there would also be a special blessing given upon Jacob's son, Judah, it was not a blessing to the exclusion of the other tribes. Suddenly, this is a family that's needing to not think in terms of one son is going to be selected and the others kind of scatter. But it is now going to be a nation that is built, and they have to start thinking like a nation. And are you thinking like a nation when you're trying to send one of your brothers off into slavery? And you're trying to kill him? And you're trying to do each one of the brothers in? They have to learn to think like a nation. And what is happening here in this section of Genesis is that we are finding that the brothers are starting to think like a family. They're starting to think like a nation. And Joseph is needing to discern this at this point. So, as we break in at Genesis 44, 1, verses 1 through 6, Joseph told his steward to incriminate his brothers and to apprehend them. Plant evidence on them, and then when they get out of the house, go and arrest them. In verses 1 through 2, Joseph told his steward to return his brother's money to them and put his silver cup into Benjamin's sack. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, "Fill the men's sacks with food and as much as they can carry, and put each man's money into the mouth of his sack. Also, put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest and his grain money." So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. It certainly looks like it's get even time. It certainly looks that way because he's saying, I want you to plant the evidence that is going to make it possible to arrest them. And who is at fault? Which brother is the mean trickster? Which brother, if he were at the men's equivalent of the ladies' retreat, is the one that's pulling all the shenanigans? Well, Joseph is here saying, plant evidence. In essence, he's saying, frame my brothers. Nice brother here. Well, then in verses 3 to 6, Joseph told his steward to apprehend his brothers for stealing his silver cup. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to his steward, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing.'" So he sends them out there to arrest the brothers and accuse them of having stolen the silver cup. Now we notice in verse 4 that he says, "Why have you repaid evil for good?" What is the good that was done? Food has been provided to this family, and if you remember, the brothers came, they made an initial trip, and when they got to camp, one of the brothers found his money was there in his sack, and they got home and they found that all their money was in their sack. Well, lo and behold, they've been given food and they've been given all their money. And each time that they have a dealing with Joseph, Joseph has provided for them. What would be their status if they had not encountered Joseph? What if God had not given the dream to Pharaoh and an interpreter? People would have been dying in droves, including Jacob's family. Joseph has clearly done good for the brothers, and they've ended up with their money back each time. I wish I could go to the store and get my money back every time I buy groceries. But why have they repaid this with evil? Why did they do something designed to hurt Joseph? I mean, after all, they've been showered with blessing and then steal, take a cup, a silver cup. And if you remember, Joseph ate his meal in their presence. He ate at a separate table, but he had that cup there. They saw it. And clearly, it's worth a great deal of money. Now, in verse 5, he mentions that it's a cup with which Joseph practices divination. We'll have more to say about that a little later. So I'm not going to go into that, but essentially, this would be a way of fortune telling, a way of being able to tell what the future holds. But we'll comment more upon it at a later point here in the passage where it comes up once again. Well, then in verses 7 through 13, the brothers gave evidence of honesty and put a curse on any thief among them. But the silver cup was in Benjamin's sack. So they returned to the city. This passage is going to give us evidence that they're starting to think like a family. They're starting to think like a nation. It isn't each one out for themselves. It isn't, I guess Benjamin's in hot water here. Nice to have known you, Benjamin. Dad's been paying a lot of attention to you, just like he paid a lot of attention to Joseph. Good riddance. Enjoy your stay here in Egypt. But no, the brothers are approaching this far differently. In verses 7 through 8, the brothers said that their return of money that was mistakenly refunded proves their innocence. Verses 7 through 8. And they said to him, "Why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servants should do such a thing. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house?" The money had been returned to them, and what did they do? They brought it back, and then Jacob said, in addition to that, bring double the money and then bring gifts for Joseph. So here they have come with much to repay Joseph. Somehow the money has ended up back in their sacks, and they say, well, we're not going to take advantage of that situation. Before my wife and I got married, we lived in Brookings, Oregon. And so one day she went to grocery store, Casey's grocery store, and bought groceries. And she gave them a check. Well, that particular night, there were some people that held up the Casey's store and took all the money and all the checks and so on and so forth. And that appeared in the newspaper. And my wife-to-be went down and wrote out another check to Casey's for the groceries that she had bought. It kind of reminds me here of... I do. That made an impression on me. And she said that the manager that she handed the check to was saying that he certainly wasn't expecting anyone to come along. They all probably thought that they had gotten free food. But the brothers have come back with the money. They've said, you know, do we really strike you as the thief type? You know, we came back with all the money, and then we came back with double the money, and we came with gifts. Does it really make sense that we would try to take a silver cup? I mean, we're probably going to need to come back in the future and buy some more grain. We didn't really want to burn our bridges. But... you know, they're operating under something like Roman law, and they don't really have a way to prove their innocence. So they thought, I bet an oath might help. So in verses 9 through 11, they made an oath. They offered for any thief among them to die. They said, "With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die. And we also will be my Lord's slaves." And he said, "Now also let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless." Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. They were in a hurry to get this over with, get back on the road, and get to their families with the grain that they have. So they figure, okay, we just got a traffic stop here. All we have to do is quickly take care of this and we'll be on our way. But they were really certain of themselves when they said, the one in whose sack it is, let him die. Remember, we've had other examples that have happened like this earlier in the book. Remember when it turned out that Laban came pursuing and he wanted his household idols? And they said, well, you know, whoever you find it with, let that person be put to death. Well, he didn't find it, but it was in one of his daughter's possessions. And she was not put to death, at least not at that point. Well, the brothers were pretty sure of themselves. They hurried, they put down their sacks, and now as they open them in verses 12 through 13, the steward found the cup in Benjamin's sack, so they returned to the city. So he searched. He began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. Now remember, when they sat down to eat the meal with Joseph, they were seated in birth order. And they couldn't imagine how that could possibly be known. But since the steward knows whose sack it's in, for dramatic effect, nothing here. And you can imagine the brothers saying, see? See? There's nothing here. Let us go. Number two, number three. Get all the way down to Benjamin. Uh-oh. They're in hot water now. And you notice they've said death sentence for Benjamin, and the rest of us will be slaves. Well, they're in a heap of hot water here. And so they tore their clothes, which ripping the clothing is a way of saying extreme mourning. They're saying, how could this possibly be? And yet they know. They know. They know how it is. They know how it came about. And they're not blaming man. They are recognizing how they, all of them except for Benjamin, had dealt with Joseph. So let's move on to the next section. In verses 14 through 30, the brothers acknowledged that God had disclosed their iniquity. In verse 14, Judah and his brothers prostrated themselves before Joseph. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there. And they fell before him on the ground. They realized that the only hope that they've got is for Joseph to be merciful. There is no other way around it. The evidence indicts Benjamin. So they came back. And their attitudes are very contrite. They are looking for mercy. In verse 15, Joseph reminded the brothers that he practiced divination. Joseph said to them, what deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination? How is it that I discovered that one of you had stolen this? And furthermore, it turns out that the cup that was taken is one that was used for divination. But does Joseph here indicate any sinfulness? No, he makes no admission of having done anything contrary to the practices that God would authorize. He says he practices divination. That is, he's able to discern the future. And that he has the cup. So on and so forth. But does he say that he's relying upon some magical powers that are in the cup? Absolutely not. Do you remember what Joseph said when he was told that, well, I've heard that you interpret dreams? He said, interpretation of dreams belongs to God. God will give Pharaoh an answer. How is it that Joseph discerns the future? It's through God. It's not through a silver cup. But as he is speaking to his brothers, he has not yet revealed who he is. And although he has mentioned before that he worships God, they would certainly expect that if he has any insight into the future, it would be by some magical practice rather than by an appeal to God himself. So Joseph leaves it fairly vague here. He doesn't explain how it is that he discerned the future. Well, in verse 16, Judah said that God disclosed their iniquity, so they were all Joseph's slaves. Then Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." Notice how Judah is speaking in terms of we. He's not speaking in terms of that one. He's not speaking in terms of Benjamin. He's speaking in terms of all of them. What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found. Is Judah trying to shift all the blame onto Benjamin? No, he isn't. He's saying this is upon all of us. Why is that the case? What had Judah done in order that Jacob would approve the plan for Benjamin to go? He said, "I will be surety. I will take the blame if anything happens to Benjamin while he is in Egypt." Judah is taking his leadership role seriously, and I believe, as I've said before, this section is where we see Judah rising to the position of leadership over all of the brothers. And it is this passage that is the reason for Genesis 49. Let's turn ahead to chapter 49. What we have in Genesis 49 before Jacob dies is his blessing upon all of his sons. And Judah was not the firstborn. He was the fourth son of Leah, and probably not even the fourth one in birth order. Look at verse 8. "Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies." Sounds like what some politicians say, but this one really means it. "Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter, which stands for his rulership over the tribes, shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people." Now, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. That's a way of speaking of procreation. There's going to be a lineage, and in the lineage of Judah, there is always going to be a lawgiver holding the scepter who's going to rule until Shiloh comes. But it's really important to recognize that Shiloh, although capitalized here, is not a proper name. Shiloh is at this point in time a phrase. She-le-oh. She, whom, le. To whom, and then the O ending is a pronominal suffix speaking of possession. The idea here is the one to whom it belongs. To whom what belongs? The scepter, the rulership. The rulership belongs to the tribe of Judah until the one to whom the scepter rightfully belongs comes and claims it. And guess who that is? The Lion of the tribe of Judah, Jesus Christ himself. But in this section, what we see happening is Judah is exercising leadership, a type of leadership that Reuben was unable to exercise. Remember how Reuben tried to get his brothers in line? Or actually to get his father to give permission for Benjamin to go? Remember what he said? Dad, if we go to Egypt and Benjamin doesn't come back, you can kill my two sons. Grandpa, just what you exactly wanted. If you lose a son, go ahead and kill a couple grandsons. Any wonder that Reuben didn't become the leader of the tribes? Judah is the one who's exercising leadership. And what type of leadership is he exercising? Is he trying to lie, cheat, and steal? No, he isn't. Think back to Simeon Levi. Think back to Genesis chapter 38. And think how they, through treachery, ended up killing a village. The type of leadership that Judah is exercising is one that is righteous. Even in the case of being unrighteously accused. Doesn't that sound like the leadership that Joseph himself also exercised? Did Joseph have bitterness? Or did he accept his plight as having come from God and sought to do right by the Lord? That seems to be the same motivation that's going on with Judah at this point. I think Judah and Joseph are two brothers in very many ways besides having the same father. Well, after disclosing their iniquity, so saying in verse 16 that God had disclosed their iniquity, Joseph put the shrews down, because what Joseph said is, I'll tell you what, the rest of you don't have to remain slaves. Joseph said that only Benjamin would be his slave. They were to go home. So in verse 17, but Joseph said, far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go up in peace to your father. Notice how Joseph has picked up upon the we statements in verse 16. Judah has said, we're all in this together. And Joseph says, no, I'm a fair man. I'm not going to imprison you all for this being found in Benjamin's sack, Benjamin is going to be my slave. This is going to show whether or not the brothers are thinking of themselves individually and whether they're willing to do in this brother Benjamin, who is clearly the favored son of Jacob. And Jacob is getting old, and you know, it would be very easy for them to rationalize, well, you know, we can just take advantage of the situation here. But Judah does not let go. Judah is insisting that's not right. It can't happen that way. And even though it might look to Joseph that it's fair, it cannot be done that way. So in verses 18 to 34, Judah interceded for Benjamin by recalling earlier conversations with Joseph about Jacob and Benjamin and how distraught Jacob was over Benjamin going to Egypt. In verses 18 through 23, Judah interceded for Benjamin by recalling how Joseph had inquired about their youngest brother and their elderly father. What Judah is doing is he is going to recall conversations where Joseph had shown interest in the family. And he wants that to, if possible, soften Joseph's heart. So in verse 18, then Judah came near to him and said, "O my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh." My Lord asked his servant, saying, "Have you a father or brother?" And we said to my Lord, "We have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him." Then you said to your servants, "Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him." And we said to my Lord, "The lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die." But you said to your servants, "Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. Judah recognizes that Joseph has the power like Pharaoh. So he's saying, "I'm not wanting to make matters worse, but will you please listen as I make a plea on behalf of my brother?" Remember that time that we came and we came to buy grain because we were destitute and you were asking questions about our family and we said, "Well, we have, yes, a brother and we have an elderly father," and then you required us to bring him, even though that may cost our father his life because this is the son of his old age and the only living son that he has from Rachel. He's saying, "You know, we didn't even have to bring him except you wanted us to bring him. And we complied with what you wanted, even though it is breaking our father's heart. And what are we going to do going back? It will kill our father." In verses 24 to 26, Judah told about telling Jacob that they could not buy food unless Benjamin came. "So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord, and our father said, 'Go back and buy us a little food.' But we said, 'We cannot go down if our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down, for we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.'" They're saying, Judah is saying, "Dad wanted us to come down here and buy some more food, but we said this Egyptian required that Benjamin be with us. It won't do us any good to go down. That's why Benjamin even came." In verses 27 through 29, Judah reiterated Jacob's distress about Benjamin going down to Egypt. "Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons. And the one went out from me, and I said, "Surely he is torn to pieces," and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave.'" They're recalling how special Benjamin was after the loss of Joseph. Jacob thinks that Joseph has been killed by a beast. And you can imagine Joseph hearing them say this, and he's thinking, "If only they knew. If only they knew." See the loyalty that has developed when Judah made himself surety for Benjamin. He is taking that role seriously. He is exercising leadership. And in that leadership, he is thinking more of his father's interest than even of his own. Wouldn't it be in his own interest for him to be free? Wouldn't it be easy to rationalize and say, "Well, for one of us to be imprisoned, oh, that's, I guess, the price we pay, collateral damage. But I was able to feed the rest of our families." But that's not the way he's approaching it. So in verses 30 through 34, Judah said that losing Benjamin would devastate Jacob. So he, as surety for Benjamin, offered himself as a slave to Joseph. He's willing to stand in his place. He's willing to take the penalty in the place of Benjamin. Verses 30 through 34. "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant, Judah, became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father?'" Judah wants Joseph to do what is right by Jacob. Joseph has shown an interest in the family, and he's shown an interest in Benjamin. And look at how, when the meal was served, how much food did Benjamin get? He got five times as much as anybody else. He had blessings poured out upon him by Joseph. Judah is saying, "I take the oath that I swore to my father seriously. You have got to let Benjamin go. I am willing to take the penalty, even if Benjamin is guilty." This is leadership. Joseph has at this point seen that his brothers are not looking for another excuse to do in a second son of Rachel. He has seen through a variety of circumstances that they are willing to stand up for their brother. And at this point, it is appropriate for him to reveal himself to his brothers. So in chapter 45, verses 1 through 8, that is exactly what he does. He revealed himself to his brothers, attributing to God his arrival in Egypt and the promotion he had received. In verses 1 through 3, Joseph sent the Egyptians out and revealed himself to his brothers, which caused his brothers to panic. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. There have been times here within this section that Joseph has had to go out from their presence because he has become overcome with emotion, and this is a point that that is happening once again. He has spoken through interpreters to the brothers, and he has acted as if he did not understand them when they spoke in Hebrew. So he made all the Egyptians leave. And you can imagine, everyone's wondering, what's going to happen now? Here he is by himself. He only speaks Egyptian. They only speak Hebrew. How are they going to communicate to one another? What is possibly happening here? And then he started crying in their midst. He had acted strong and aloof in their presence. And his wailing is loud enough that in the adjoining household of Pharaoh and those in his court also hear this. So then he said in verse 3, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" Now, can you imagine the brothers thinking, oh no. Oh, now it's all coming clear. Benjamin's going to be free and the rest of us are dead men because of what we did to Joseph. You can just imagine all their thinking going through their head and they don't know what to say, so they don't say anything. They're dismayed in his presence and it's like, who would have ever expected this? And yet, what have they been saying? God has found the iniquity of your servants. Now, when Judah had said that, did he say, "We stole your cup"? He was talking about a different iniquity. Because what was it that they said when the cup, or when they found in one of the brothers' sacks the money returned to them? God has found us out. Because they're thinking, how will we ever explain this money? If we don't bring it back, they're going to say we're thieves. If we bring it back, it's kind of awkward to say, here's your money. Somehow we ended up with it in our possession. How did you end up with it in your possession? Do you have someone with sticky fingers? I mean, you know, it's a really awkward situation. So they were thinking, we're going to be condemned. And now here they are before Joseph, and they're saying, oh, no. No wonder he was showing such favoritism towards Benjamin. We're all dead men. In verse 4 through 5a, Joseph repeated that he was their brother whom they had sold into slavery, but they were not to be angry with themselves. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, Do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. He has reiterated who he is. But he could be coming down and saying, okay, you're dead men. But he's not interested at this point in them beating themselves over what they had already clearly dealt with. Because remember what happened when he was speaking through an interpreter. He heard them say to one another that God was disciplining them for what they had done to Joseph. He's saying, you've already dealt with that. You know what it's like when we confess our sins after we have committed them? Do we have to confess the same sin over and over and over and over and over and over and over again? God hears us, and God is faithful to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Joseph is saying, this has already been dealt with. Don't beat yourself up over this. Because he certainly isn't beating them up over it. But you can imagine, the brothers are thinking, Joseph wants to do us in. And that's the natural first response here. He's saying, stop beating yourselves up over this. It's already taken care of. And then he's going to give the reason that they don't need to beat themselves up over it any longer. In verse 5b through 7, the reason they were not to be angry with themselves is because God sent Joseph to Egypt for a great deliverance of them. Verse 5b, but we'll start at 5a. But now do not therefore be angry, aggrieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Joseph is saying that the brothers were not ultimately responsible for him being there. God is. God made it so that he could deliver his brothers. You remember how the brothers thought it was so terrible when Joseph told them one of his dreams when he was 17 years old of seeing his brother's sheaves bowing down to his sheaf. I said, you're going to rule over us? And then he had another dream, and he told it even to his father about the sun and the moon and 11 stars. And the symbolism there was father, mother, all bowing down to Joseph. And the brothers bowing down as well. And he's saying, God is the one that sent me here. God is fulfilling the dreams that he had given to Joseph. And it wasn't just to glorify or honor Joseph, but it was to preserve the nation. God is the one that has made it so that he is in this role. Verse 8. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord over all his house, and ruler throughout the land of Egypt. When he speaks about being a father to Pharaoh, he's his chief advisor. He's the number two man. But how did Joseph get this position? You know, that's not the normal career track for a slave being sold and then being accused of raping or attempted rape of his master's wife and then being thrown into prison, you know, that's not the normal career track that you would expect to see someone follow. But it's the career track that God had for him in order to protect the nation. God is the one who is ultimately responsible for Joseph being there. Brothers can't even take credit for having gotten him started on that career track. It was God who was responsible for it all. Verses 9 through 15, Joseph told his brothers to hurry to bring Jacob to Egypt so that they would have plenty during the famine, and they embraced. In verse 9, he told them to hurry to tell Jacob of Joseph's God-given position. Verse 9, hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. It is God who is to receive the credit. And so they are to hurry and they are to give good news about how God has provided deliverance through Joseph down in Egypt. And yes, Joseph still lives. And now the brothers are going to have to say, well, yeah, Dad, we kind of told you a tale. They're going to have to own up to what they had misled him all these years about, some wild beast having killed Joseph. In verses 10 and 11, Joseph said that they would have plenty during the following 5 years of famine. Remember, it's a seven-year famine, and they're only 2 years into it. There are going to be five more years. So in verses 10 and 11, you shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me, you and your children and your children's children, your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. Okay. As he looks ahead to these 5 years of famine, he says, as you come here, you're going to be provided for. You're not going to be suffering. Everything's going to be provided first class. In verses 12 and 13, Joseph acknowledged that they recognized him, so they needed to hurry to bring Jacob to Egypt. Behold, your eyes and the eyes of your brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and all that you have seen. And you shall hurry and bring my father down. They recognized him, so therefore they needed to hurry. They needed to bring this all about. And then in verses 14 and 15, then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and after that, his brothers talked with him. Notice how Joseph has embraced Benjamin and all of his other brothers, and then they caught up. They had a chance to renew their fellowship with one another. At this point, the brothers are finally seeing that Joseph is using his God-given role to preserve them as a family. And you can imagine the conversation that they would have had after all of the hurt and all of the things that have gone on within this family, where they were thinking as individuals and not thinking as a nation, but God is bringing them together as a nation. As Moses is writing this book, he's writing it to a bunch of people who are slaves in Egypt, who need to think like a nation. And they need to be focused upon the God who is going to be as faithful to them as he was to the patriarchs. At our beginning, we looked at Jake DeShazer. He fought. He did what he was supposed to do as he was in the military. But then he realized that his job profile switched. And his job profile was to seek to win others for the Lord. It wasn't to bear animosity towards people who were not responsible for the decisions that had plunged the nation into war. Remember, I told you that he had a book, but something very interesting about what happened as a result of the book being published. The man that you see on the left is Mitsuo Fushida. Mitsuo Fushida was lead pilot for the first wave of planes that attacked Pearl Harbor. And it was his responsibility, when they knew whether or not they had been discovered or whether they were, it was a pure surprise attack, he was to say, "Tora, Tora, Tora," if it was a complete surprise. And he uttered those words, and the Japanese high command knew that Pearl Harbor was a total surprise. But Mitsuo Fushida read the book by Jake DeShazer and was drawn to find out more about Jesus Christ. Because he saw that this man who had fought for his country, but who had a new role, made sense. And he saw also that Jesus Christ had paid his sin penalty, paid the death penalty, and he could see a reason to live his life out in a new direction because of the Jesus Christ that he discovered through the ministry of Jake DeShazer. And they became good friends for the rest of their lives and ministered together on many occasions in Japan. The power of forgiveness is tremendous. And we see that here with Joseph in the passage that we have seen. We saw Judah also rise above the things that had bothered him about his father's favoritism towards one of the sons. Leadership was being exercised as people rose up into the roles that God had now given them. Their roles had changed. And we have a message, and our message to people is that although man, because of antagonism towards God way back in the garden, has been plunged into death, but Jesus Christ doesn't want to have to assume his role of judge over all of humanity. He wants another role that was given to him also by the Father. That was the role of life giver to those who would believe in him for everlasting life during this life. In John chapter 5, verse 24, Jesus said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life." Jesus would far prefer for people to come to him to receive life than for him to need to judge them at the great white throne to see whether or not they deserve life, because no one at the great white throne will deserve life. They will all end up with eternal death.